thanks for having me. My name is Josh. I've been at Penn for 10 years, and I've been a geriatrician for that time. And one thing I do all the time is help people make serious medical decisions, particularly at the end of life. So I work in a nursing home. I'm the medical director of a nursing home. I'm the fellowship director for the geriatric fellowship at Penn. I do a lot of teaching. I work in the hospital. I work in the office. The one thing I don't do anymore is house calls. But I finished medical school almost 20 years ago. And it's been a while, and I've had the chance to take care of a lot of patients. I guess the reason that I want to speak here, because I actually see 10th members at my office. But the advantage of talking about this subject here is I will get Christian patients in my office, and they will be presented and faced with a medical decision. And the medical decision and their spiritual life, they have a hard time making that intersect when they're sitting in my office. And the reason to bring the medical decisions into a faith setting is to understand the faith context for these medical decisions. So that's the whole point of me coming here. let's go ahead and go to the next slide. Again, the goal of this time is that when it is time for you to die, that you will have... you will be able to die well. This 1 hour, 10-minute session that we have together isn't going to be a trick, but it'll at least introduce the subject. And it'll help you help others to die well, Christian or not. By the end of the session, you'll be able to describe ways to encourage and walk with someone who is dying. That is not something that a lot of us are used to. We are going to discuss one medical decision, code status, in detail, but we'll touch on a couple of So we'll talk about the pros and cons of some of these value-sensitive code medical decisions or interventions. And in front of you, we're going to talk about living wills, advanced directives, power of attorneys, and a pulsed form. And you have an example of a living will that I wrote for myself. So let's go ahead and go to the poll everywhere poll. You can just control tab over. And you can bring out your smartphones. And so I have discussed, if you move the cursor maybe to the left side, there you go. I've discussed with friends, read a book, attended a learning session on death and dying before. It's probably better to do it by going to the browser, but you can do it by texting. And let's see if this works. It should be activated. Let me make sure that I have it activated. Should be active, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Somebody took back their vote. All right, let's go ahead and go to the next question. There's a couple, so we'll just go through these. This is just to give me an idea of who's here. So I've had someone close to me die in the last year. And I do appreciate that for some people this can be quite a difficult topic. Okay, let's go to the next question. I am comfortable walking with someone who is dying. Okay. I think I have another one. One more. When it comes to my own death, I am fully prepared. I have prepared, discussed with family, and documented my thoughts and wishes on one end of the scale. In the middle, I've thought about it, haven't taken any steps, and on the bottom end, I don't even want to think about it, or it's very uncomfortable for me, or to even think or talk about my own death. Yes. So number two is just in between. So it's just a continuous or a Likert scale. And those are just your anchors. Okay. All right. And I think that's the last one. Is there another one? Oh, yeah. I am the designated healthcare decision maker for someone else. Yeah, I should have had a follow-up question. If you answer no, do you have a parent who's alive? Because then the answer is probably going to be yes at some point. But in any case, okay. And then I think that's the last one. Is there one more? Okay. We'll go over to the slides, and we're going to disconnect the internet, and we will move on. So... there are some vignettes. We're not going to discuss these right now. But let's say you're admitted to the hospital for an infection. The doctor asks you, if your heart were to stop beating, would you want to be resuscitated? Routine question. Every patient admitted to every hospital in the U.S. is supposed to be asked this question. Next vignette. Your mother has cancer that has not been cured with multiple treatment options. There is one more treatment option, but it's risky, unlikely to work. Has a lot of side effects. Do you turn it down or do you go for it? Your family members in the intensive care unit on a ventilator, the doctor suggests transitioning to hospice, disconnecting your family member from the ventilator, which would lead to his or her death. How do you decide? Okay. So let's go over the outline. First, we're going to start with just death and dying from a medical perspective. Just some real basics about that. We're going to go over some and the role of surrogate decision makers and patients for themselves. We're going to talk about specific interventions, and again, I'm going to focus on code status as a fairly concrete. There's obviously a million different types of medical interventions that people are faced with. We're going to talk about what does a physician mean when they say goals of care. Goals of care is a fairly broad term. And it's supposed to guide end-of-life decisions, but what does a physician actually mean? We're going to talk about death from a Christian perspective. God has a lot to say about this. The title of this talk came from one of my colleagues, actually my former division chair or chief, was spending time talking with two sons of a patient who was dying in the hospital. And both were pastors. And both were talking about how their mother was a believer and she looked forward to being in heaven. And this woman was actively dying. And they talked about the strength of her faith. They talked about her anticipation of being in heaven. And then when it was time to make a medical decision, they said, yes, but we don't want anything that would hasten her death. We want her to be kept alive at all costs. So they left her as a full code. It was almost an irrelevant decision in that she died within the next 24 hours anyway. But my colleague felt it was very ironic to hear two pastors talk in the same conversation about how amazing and wonderful heaven is. At the same time, they wanted to do everything they could to postpone the death of their mother, even though they really actually had no ability to do so. We're going to talk about death from a Christian perspective. We'll talk about what it means to die well, knowing that setting up an aspirational goal can often bring stigma to people who don't live up to that goal. So we're going to talk about both what it could look like and what it does look like. And I have just spent countless times with families bedside and have seen a lot. And then we'll get back to the nitty-gritty of what does it mean to actually document this and put it down in writing. All right, so let's go to the next slide. And we're going to leave time at the end for questions and answers. So I had a patient ask me this. So I said to him, he was older, I'm a geriatrician. Most of my patients are in their 80s. Some of my patients are in their 90s. None of you guys are old enough to have me as a physician. And I do mean none of you. Occasionally I'll have some patient that turns 65, and I really would rather not see people that young. But I had a patient who was older, and we were talking about advanced directives, and I said to him, I said, where would you like to be? Like, when you think about the end of your life, where do you think you will, where would you want to be? And he looks at me, he's like, well, how am I supposed to know where I am when I die? He had this idea in his head that one day he would just keel over dead, and he could be anywhere. And so what was the point of the question? So let's go to the next slide, or hit forward. There's actually, it's not as unpredictable as that. It is somewhat predictable to figure out how people die. Outside of traumas and car accidents and the such, which can be fairly unpredictable, and some really rare things, sudden cardiac death and certain heart disease in younger people, for the most part, most people will end up dying of one of these three trajectories, either cancer, organ failure, or dementia. Let's go to the next slide. Hit forward again. The slide didn't quite, nope, hit back, I guess. The slide didn't load right for some reason. Let's just hit forward. So this is the trajectory of somebody dying from cancer. And the y-axis or the vertical axis is function, high function, low function, or good health and death. And then the x-axis is time. And what we see in people with cancer is even as they go through stage 1, 2, 3, 4 cancer, they stay fairly functional. If any of you saw the last lecture by a professor with metastatic pancreatic cancer, he was doing push-ups 6 months before he ended up dying from his cancer. People can stay extremely functional up until the very end, even as the cancer continues to spread. A couple weeks before a person dies, now this is more typical of solid cancers, breast, lung cancer, more than leukemias, lymphomas. But a couple weeks before somebody dies, they may start rapidly losing weight, becoming fatigued. But I have spent many, many days with patients who are dying from cancer, speaking with them verbally, a couple weeks before they were dead, and they had a very rapid decline at the very end. And so the way you stage or the way you get some sense of how close they are is you get a sense of how bad the cancer is, and then there's certain end-of-life markers, such as weight loss, that tells you you're very, very close to the end. But cognition is usually not one of the markers. Patients with cancer can stay lucid until the very, very end. It's both a blessing and a curse of cancer. Let's go to the next slide. This slide is typical of people with organ failure. So you can think of end-stage renal disease, heart failure, end-stage lung disease such as emphysema. What happens in these patients is they will have an exacerbation. Something will make their heart failure worse. They'll recover, but not quite to where they were before. And they'll have another exacerbation and another exacerbation. And then during one of the exacerbations, they can't quite recover, and they will die. During this time, you also have lead-in time, where during the hospitalizations before one's death, during these recurrent hospitalizations, the key is that you don't want people to think of these as one-off events, but really sort of as markers on a trajectory towards one's death. But a lot of times people will think that as long as they make it through the exacerbation, they're back to how they were before. But the body is never quite exactly the same. Let's go to the next one. Now, what I actually deal with most, especially in a nursing home setting, is dementia. And dementia is the person dies not because of a specific organ and not because of cancer, but in the setting of really extreme frailty. And the challenge with frailty, which can occur in other settings other than dementia, but the challenge with frailty is the person is kind of on death's door for a long time. They can survive. I have been fooled by frailty more times than anything else. The person can live longer than I think, and they can live not as long as I think. Where I've had patients where I said, listen, you only have a couple months. One person ended up living 5 more years after I said that to them. Other times when I told a patient that they were fine, and I've had patients die that night after me telling them that they were fine. And so frailty and dementia are very difficult to predict. It's just one of those things. So the person has severe functional deficits for a prolonged period before the time they finally die. And during this time, there are value-sensitive decisions that need to be made. We can go ahead one more. So death from a medical perspective is that there's a couple of issues. One is that there are decisions that involve values. At some point, people are faced with dilemmas where they're having to pick, do I want an intervention that's going to help me live longer, or do I want to pick interventions that are going to help me live with a better quality of life? You're forced to make decisions. So, for example, if I have stage 4 cancer, do I want systemic chemotherapy that is going to make me nauseated and weak but might buy me a month, or would I rather feel better and live a shorter amount of time? Now, in an ideal setting, you would have both. So I've had patients that when I've presented these trade-off decisions, they're like, I'd rather have both. I'm like, that's great. I would rather give you both if I could. But I said, that's not the option we have right now. We have to make a decision. And some people will engage with me on that. Most people will. And some people, they just want both. And unfortunately, it doesn't happen. Another issue is even when patients know what they want, they know who they are, they know what matters to them, it's often not documented, and even if it's documented, it's not followed. The other thing is surrogates don't know. So although the 68% is a little higher than other articles, I was looking this up earlier today. So if a parent has values, end-of-life wishes, and goals, and you put them in one room and you say, write it down. And you put their children in a separate room and you say, write it down. It's a little bit better than a coin flip whether the children get it right. Now, that happens for a variety of reasons. Sometimes the children say, I don't care what my mom wants. I want her to get what I want her to get. Okay? We project a lot. Sometimes patients change. So I had my mom fill out one of the forms in front of you. My mom checked off, I would want to die alone. And I'm just like, Mom, what'd you check that off for? So we often don't get it right. And you don't get it right unless you talk about it. Let's go on to the next. Now, the issue for families and decision makers is that there is significant burden from making these end-of-life decisions on behalf of somebody else. So when they look at from making the decision, so you're a surrogate, your mother or father is dying, the doctor says to you, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to put them on a ventilator? You say no. What we know is that for about a third of children making the decisions for their parents, for months to years afterwards, the distress from that decision is severe enough to meet the criteria for anxiety, depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder. It is that burdensome. Now, that's a third. The glass is two-thirds full. Some people find that the opportunity to make that decision for their parent is an opportunity to love their parent. But the stress of it can't be understated. One thing we find is that when parents write down decisions in a document, it relieves stress and burden on the children. The other issue that I deal with is disagreement among family members. And this ends up in court. I've had to testify in court down at City Hall and other places. Probably my most memorable family meeting is when six children showed up with six lawyers and I had to meet with all 12 of them. But I've been involved in lawsuits, family members suing each other. Somebody wants their loved one to receive care of a certain type and somebody else has a differing opinion. And I have seen families completely estranged by the time that their loved one dies, where their children will just never speak to each other ever again. And that happens quite a bit, unfortunately. Okay. So from a medical perspective, one time I had a daughter bring her mom in to see me in the office. I said, well, what would you like me to do for you and your mother? And she's like, well, I want my mom to live to 150. So I look at her and I appreciate that sometimes people present factual statements, but they're really emotive statements. What she's saying is, I don't want my mom to die. And I do appreciate that. The Onion, on the other hand, has an article that the death rate in America hasn't changed. One out of one people still dies. But I appreciate that that statement wasn't a statement of unintelligence. It was an emotional statement. Anyways, I couldn't make her mother live to 150. But there is often a time before one's death where you can figure out that a person is dying. Sometimes physicians don't recognize it. Sometimes patients don't recognize it. Sometimes families don't recognize it. But the clues are there. There are opportunities to make decisions at the end of one's life. And for older adults, many older adults will lose the ability to speak for themselves some point before they die. And it's going to be up to the surrogate or the doctor that they've prepared ahead of time. Now, my parents actually have not made any of these documents. I probably talk to them about once a year. I usually pick a terrible time like Thanksgiving or Christmas to do it. But they have not put these issues in writing for themselves. They just tell me that I know what they want. Yeah. All right, so let's go over some medical interventions. So these are hard. I will tell you that families do not naturally talk about these type of things, Christian or not. We're going to talk about code status, intensive care unit stay, other burdensome interventions, and sort of a working definition of heroic measures. What does it mean when somebody says heroic measures? So let's talk about code status. So a code status, otherwise known as cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, it's what you see on TV shows. I don't actually watch a lot of TV, but, ER, what is it, Grey's Anatomy, and shows like this, where somebody's heart stops beating, you rush in the room, you do chest compressions, and then the person either lives or dies. That's how it's depicted on TV. And cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, is a medical intervention that only applies when somebody is dead. If you're not dead, your code status is irrelevant. It's when your heart is not beating and you are not breathing. Do you want me to do CPR? That's the question I ask people. Do you want me to try to bring you back to life after you died with full life support? And so the purpose of CPR is to bring people who have died back to life. This does not mean that if I choose to be do not resuscitated, that I can't have other life-sustaining interventions. It's a very specific situation. When I am dead, either I want somebody to try to bring me back to life or I don't. It's a binary decision. Next step, the procedure involves chest compressions, intubation, which is a tube down your throat connected to a machine, electrical shocks on the chest, some medications, and usually intensive care units stay after the procedure. Okay? Chest compressions, we'll talk about this in a second, are rough. I've done it many times myself, not as many times as my ER buddies, but I've had opportunities to do it. It's never fun. Next, the outcomes are this. In the hospital, about 50% of the time when somebody's heart stops beating, we never restart it. It just doesn't work. About 30% of the time we restart the heart only to have the person die in the hospital and not make it out of the hospital alive. So that's what I call a prolonged death or delaying death. You make it work, but they still don't make it out of the hospital. They die anyway. Now, sometimes, about 20% of the time, people will actually make it out of the hospital. And probably roughly half of those people have significant brain damage, where they have to go from living independently to living in a nursing home, being independent in their certain daily functions to being dependent on somebody else. So they have a change in function or institutionalization because of the brain damage. And about 10% of the time, slightly less, you end up alive the way you are. So that's the outcomes of CPR. Now everybody looks at me when I say these sort of numbers to patients, and they say, yeah, but my mom's a fighter. My dad's a fighter. They're going to be better than average. Now, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie Dumb and Dumber. There's this scene. This sounds a little worse than I mean it. But there's a scene where Jim Carrey says to the woman, what are my chances of us getting together? And the woman, he says, 1 in 1,000? She's like, no. Eventually he says, 1 in 1,000,000? She's like, yeah. And he turns around and says, so you're saying there's a chance? And ends up ecstatic and excited. Now, I have said to people, your chances of surviving CPR well is about 5 or 10%. Only to have the person look at me and say, I'll take it. Sounds like a great deal. The point of these numbers is that most people are going to be disappointed by their outcome. So you have to be ready for that. If you are a full code, and I am a full code right now, I appreciate fully that the most likely thing that happened is it's not going to work. The second most likely thing that happened is that I will have my heart restarted only to die in the hospital. Third, that I'm going to live with brain damage. Fourth, it may actually return me to how I am today. But it just isn't that likely. All right, next slide. The risks are significant. So I had a patient who had CPR, didn't work. She ended up getting an autopsy. She was an 80-some-year-old woman. She ended up having 18 rib fractures from the chest compressions. And that's only because it was done right. What I usually tell patients is the problem with CPR is if it works, you're going to feel it. You're really going to feel it. The most hopeful thing is that if you break 18 ribs, that you don't ever get a chance to feel that. Second is the prolonged death. When somebody survives but with significant brain damage or underlying heart issues from being down, and they die anyway, now a couple things happen. Now they might feel their death. Instead of having a death due to an arrhythmia, an electrical short circuit, where you just fall asleep and you're gone, now you might be short of breath, you might be in pain, you might be aware enough to actually feel what's coming your way. You replace a painless death with one that you will feel over days to weeks. Second, the family member often has to make a decision to pull the loved one off a vent, and you replace an easier decision with a harder decision. Lastly is, I'm not convinced that people are ready to live significantly brain damaged. And usually what I tell people is when we restart the heart, we don't always restart the brain. It's what I call coming back halfway. And these are the risks of CPR. CPR is not for everybody, okay? You have to be ready to deal with any of these outcomes if you are a full code. Now, the way I'm ready for it, well, there's two issues. One is I've set some limits. I don't want to be stuck on a ventilator forever. And if I have anoxic brain damage, I don't want a feeding tube put in. The second is my wife, though, has veto power over any decision I make. And so she'll ultimately decide what happens to me. But those are my sort of safeguards for not permanently landing in a spot I don't want to land. Choices are binary. You don't get to pick. You either want somebody to try to bring you back to life or you don't want somebody to bring you back to life. All the interventions, chest compressions, intubations, electrical shocks, work together. Trying to go with just one or two of these things is like a one-hand clap or a one-winged airplane. It doesn't work. It's futile. And so either we try an effective intervention or we don't try. So sometimes people will be presented with sort of a Burger King menu of choices, doesn't work. The second decision that I use to test people about what they think about CPR when they tell me that they're full code is I say, fine, but if it works, the more likely thing is that you're going to come back halfway. So the question is, how long would you want to be stuck on a vent? And would you want a feeding tube placed? And if they say, I would want to be stuck on a vent for maybe a week, or I wouldn't want a permanent feeding tube, or I'm okay being on a ventilator forever, or I'm okay having a feeding tube in forever, then I know that they've heard me, that coming back halfway is actually the most likely success outcome. By the way, you guys can stop me at any time if you have questions. Yes? Correct. So, correct. Because a lot of times we don't know exactly the outcome when it first starts. Usually after a week we have a pretty good idea. And so that's called a time-limited trial. We use that when there's uncertain outcomes, and we'll get to that in just a second. Okay. Children are a completely different story, and the outcomes are different. But young adults are the same as older adults. And the reason that young adults have dismal outcomes from CPR is because it's due to overdoses of toxins or trauma. And the success from trauma and toxins is not great. The best success from CPR is when you're a 55-year-old guy with chest pain, you go into the hospital for a rule-out heart attack, you have a heart attack, you go into a cardiac intensive care unit, and they're ready for you to have an arrest. But if you go in because of depression, suicide risk, overdose, and you're on a general medical floor, and your heart stops, nobody's ready. Or if you come in with a gunshot wound or a knife stab to your chest or a car accident where they can't stop the bleeding. So believe it or not, 18 to 30-year-olds have the same success rates as 80-plus-year-olds from CPR. Young people don't do well, but it's for different reasons. It's because the underlying problem is so catastrophic. Questions? All right. We're good. Now, while a person is alive, now this is where you fall into the myriad of options about limits of sustaining care. And I'm going to talk about one, which is the intensive care unit. Has anybody been in an ICU? Just show of hands. Yeah, it's not a pretty place. Since being a third-year medical student, when I walk in the ICU, I cannot make the beeping stop. There are more machines that are beeping than I can handle, and to this day, I can't figure out how to make all these machines stop. The ICU is where the fullness of modern medical technology comes to bear. Anything you can do to a person, you can do to them in an ICU. So what the most obvious one is a breathing machine, a tube down the throat with a machine pumping air into your lungs. Medications in the veins, sometimes through large bore central catheters, either underneath your clavicle, sometimes in your groin. Aggressive monitoring, so frequent labs, sometimes you're drawing blood every hour with needle pokes. Catheters in the vein, like an arterial blood arterial line. Catheters in the bladder, catheters in the rectum. Aggressive interventions, balloon pumps, endoscopies, feeding tubes, bronchs. I mean, it goes on. The ICU is where physicians are given a blank check to just go at it. Whatever they need to do to keep you alive can be done in an intensive care unit. Sometimes it's uncomfortable enough that we have to sedate the patients. Usually on a ventilator, we're sedating patients. You can see in this picture, the guy's on a vent, lady's on a vent. She has a feeding tube in her mouth. She's restrained because they don't want her to pull anything out, and she's not conscious, and this is not unusual picture at all. So here's the dilemma, next slide, for the ICU. That the ICU interventions are not comfortable. They hurt. I've had friends in ICUs. They were able to tell me that it is not comfortable at all. Sometimes people are so sick that they are unconscious enough that they don't remember. So I'll see them in my office after an ICU stay, And I'll say, Mrs. Smith, you were just in the ICU? She's like, yeah, that's what they tell me. I'm like, how'd it go? And she's like, I don't remember. And I said, well, that's sort of a blessing. Next. The outcomes are uncertain. I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations with people where they said, only put me in the ICU if it's going to work. Well, this is the point, is we don't know if it's going to work. When I, not me, when somebody puts a tube in a patient's throat to help them breathe from pneumonia or heart failure or whatever, you don't know what the outcome is. If you knew what the outcome would be, either you wouldn't do it or it wouldn't be a tough decision. It's uncertain. So people say to me all the time, only do it if it's going to be successful. And the answer is, I don't know. As an intern, I remember being in an ICU and intubating somebody who was awake. And I said to him, I said, we don't know if this tube is going to come out of your throat. And he told me to do it anyway. The tube never ended up coming out. So sometimes it works. Sometimes people will die anyway. The decisions are tricky. So some people actually want to make decisions ahead of time. Other people only make decisions in retrospect. Whether it's picking a college or a job or what you're going to do on vacation or what you're going to order at a restaurant. Some people know what they want before they get there, and other people want to wait and see and get there in the moment and then see how they feel. The problem is that the ICU is a bad place to make decisions in retrospect. But one thing I've learned is I can't force people to make decisions any quicker. What I usually tell people is you can only bake a cake so fast. And if somebody can only make a decision at a certain rate, well, then you're just stuck with that rate for that patient. And sometimes you do things to patients and you know that they would not have wanted it if they had enough time, and there just isn't enough time. So sometimes people do make decisions ahead of time, but I've learned over the years that that is just not true of everybody. Sometimes you can make a time-limited trial. So the people who say, only do it to me if it works, what I say to them is, what we can do is we can put you on a ventilator for a week or two and see if it works, and then you can make the decision ahead of time to say, after this amount of time, take me off the ventilator, because then it's not worth it to me. The challenge with that decision is some people end up permanently stuck on a ventilator out of inertia. It is really, really emotionally difficult to stop a ventilator for some people. And some faith backgrounds, Orthodox Jewish backgrounds, you're not allowed to. So in Israel, I've been told that a lot of ventilators on a 24-hour timer, so that way every day you have to turn it on. So that way when you stop a ventilator, you're not withdrawing the vent, you're just not turning it on the next day. I have a patient at my nursing home right now. He's like 35 years old, persistent vegetative state. Been in that state for 2 years. If you guys remember Terry Schiavo, very similar. Wife wants to stop tube feedings. Parents don't want to stop. And the wife said, if I had known he would have ended up this way, we wouldn't have done it in the first place. But stopping it's going to be much, much more difficult. Keep going. All right. Next slide. We're not going to talk about dialysis. But again, dialysis is artificial life support for organs. And the challenge is, when do you stop it? There's a lot of inertia in medicine. And the question is, when do you stop it? This is what it looks like. But there's so many devices. There's left ventricular assist devices, which is an artificial external heart. There's defibrillators. There's breathing machines that people strap on at night at home. There's no end to the number of machines that people can be hooked up to nowadays, and these are each dilemma in their own way. Now, heroic care, you can go ahead. My working definition is that heroic care is care that routinely causes suffering. It's an intrinsically burdensome intervention even when it works. It has a fairly low chance of working, a high chance of complications, and therefore, it's a fairly futile intervention. It's unlikely to achieve meaningful therapeutic or curative goals. It's a temporizing measure that delays death, buys a little bit of time, but it doesn't tend to fix any underlying problems, a shot in the dark. Now, an intervention can be curative for one person but heroic for another. And we can go to the next slide. And this is what I mean. So you can imagine ventilator care. I've had friends on ventilators. Now, if you're on a ventilator because you have an underlying disease that is not fixable, your lung is so full of tumor that it can't oxygenate, your heart is so bad that it can't pump, then you have a weakened immune system, you can't fight off infection. Putting you on a ventilator isn't going to fix that. Whereas if somebody has a pneumonia and they need to be on a ventilator for 3 days to buy time for the antibiotics to work, that's a curative intervention. Next. The outcome is unchanged if it's heroic care. The person's going to die anyway. Aggressive care, which is appropriate, the outcome can be radically changed by the use of aggressive intervention. The suffering for heroic care is the suffering is intolerable. For aggressive care, it might not be tolerable, but it might be worth it. So I'll give you an example. I had a patient with metastatic cancer in the hospital, and he could not tolerate an IV or a blood draw. And the surgeons were saying that his only option was to get this aggressive surgery to strip the lining from his lungs, probably one of the more painful surgeries a person can undergo. And he couldn't take a blood draw with a 22-gauge butterfly needle. So I asked him, I said, what's the deal? You know, you're asking for us to pursue this aggressive intervention that is more painful than you can tolerate. After a long story, turns out that this was a guy that went to my church. And the solution really wasn't a medical issue. It wasn't a health literacy issue. Our pastor came in, spent some time with him. He transitioned onto hospice and died within 24 hours. But suffering can be intolerable. It may be worth it for some people, may not. And then finally, the complications in a heroic case are devastating in the sense that we put people on chemo, and we can actually shorten their life. They would have been better off not receiving chemo. They would have lived longer without chemo. They would have lived longer without an aggressive surgery. So sometimes heroic measures will actually shorten, in the pursuit of longevity, will shorten somebody's life. Okay, next slide. All right. So again, CPR is for when somebody's dead. And while somebody's alive, there's a myriad of medical interventions that all need different frameworks to think about the pros and cons. All right, goals of care. Now, goals of care from a medical perspective involves three things. The broad issue is what matters to a patient. One is longevity. Do I still care about living longer? I had a 94-year-old patient in my nursing home, and I was prescribing him like 4 or 5 medications for his blood pressure, for his heart. And one day I went to see him, and he's like, Doc, why are you having me take all these medications? I said, well, this one's for your heart. He interrupts me. He goes, what are you trying to do, make me live to 95? And he goes, I'm not suicidal. I'm not depressed. But he says to me, I'm fine with dying. I don't want to live any longer. I'm at peace. I've lived my life. Living longer was not a goal for him. He's like, I've outlived my family. I've outlived my friends. I'm not living in my home anymore. I'm not suffering, but I don't need to be kept alive anymore. So we actually stopped his medications, and probably within a year he passed away. But this was a guy who, at that point in his life, he actually was at peace with not living longer. I will tell you that older adults can often get to that point faster than their children. Quality of life. There's sort of three categories: physical, social, emotional. What does it mean to be comfortable? What does a good physical quality of life mean? Social, relationally, what matters to me? What are my hobbies? What do I like to do? Emotional, what makes me happy? Finally, function is very functionally oriented. Activities of daily living: bathing, dressing, feeding, grooming, ambulation, continence, driving, very functionally oriented. And these three things together can define goals of care. And the question for goals of care to the next page is, what is ideal? What is tolerable? And what is intolerable? What would be a quality of life worse than death? Where if I were to be in that quality of life, I actually would be longing to die because the suffering would be more than I could bear. Now, there's a couple that I can think of. I wouldn't want to be stuck on a vent. I really, really wouldn't want to be stuck on a vent. I really, really wouldn't probably want to be in a locked-in syndrome where I could understand what's going on, but I couldn't interact with the world. That would drive me crazy. I like to talk too much. But otherwise, I'm not sure. And again, the question is, how do I deal with trade-offs? If I had to choose longevity versus comfort or quality of life or function. So for example, would I rather have a below-the-knee amputation to keep me from dying from my foot wound, but it would permanently place me in a nursing home because of the resources I have or the lack of? Or would I rather just die from my foot wound with my leg intact? That's a decision discussion I've had with many patients. Now, prior to 1980, the physician, this wasn't even a question that patients could decide for themselves. Physicians decided. So one of the first cases, I think Quinlan, was it Cruzan or Quinlan? Quinlan was the first one in the 70s. The issue was that the court said initially, well, the physicians are the ones who make these decisions. The landmark decision is that the patient got to choose based off of privacy interpretation of the law. But we state these sort of decisions as the patient gets to decide. There's a document called Your Life, Your Choices that is very patient-centered. And even for the American Geriatric Society, the question that they want everybody to ask patients is, what matters to you? The reality is that families often disagree, and it can lead to, these are value-sensitive decisions. There's not a right or wrong answer when it comes to this. Next page. Now, this is what I want to spend actually a decent amount of time on, is the Christian perspective of death. What is the role of faith in making medical decisions? Should we pray for miracles? What medical care should we pursue while praying for a miracle? What do we hope for when a doctor says you have 3 months to live? What does it mean to believe in the sanctity of life? I grew up and still am in a pro-life family and a very pro-life. Do we have to do everything? Is it wrong to pull somebody off a ventilator? Is it wrong to stop dialysis in a stable patient? Is it wrong to stop tube feeding? Is it wrong to allow somebody to voluntarily stop eating? What about euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide? And this is my world. These are the things that I have to deal with. And what is the role of hospice for a Christian? So these are some things. So let's go on to the next one. And some verses that have meant a lot to me. The first one is a one that we know well. There is a time for death, from Ecclesiastes. There is a time to be born and a time to die. Who lived forever? There's one guy that walked with God. Enoch did not die. And I suppose Elijah went straight up as well. But for the rest of us, there's a time to be born and a time to die. In Hebrews, it says that just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. It is no mystery to God that we are going to die. People might be surprised. Every so often, somebody isn't surprised. My wife's favorite story is I had a 92, 93-year-old woman who I was constipated, had some belly pain. I did a CT scan, shows metastatic colon cancer. Bring her into the office on a Friday afternoon with her daughter, and I say to her, Mrs. Smith, I have some bad news for you. The CAT scan shows that you have colon cancer, and it is spread. Now, she was hard of hearing, and she paused, and I didn't know if she heard me, because sometimes I lower my voice when I'm saying something that's hard for me to say. But then she looks at me and says, well, I'm 93. I knew it was going to be something. So sometimes people are ready. They know. Other times, they really don't know, and they think they might live forever. But we know that God has appointed for man to die once. Next. God is present. This is a verse I share with people all the time. Psalm 46 is one of my favorite psalms, period. God is an ever-present help in times of trouble. If you know anything about suffering, suffering makes you feel alone. When you're suffering, you think nobody understands what I'm going through. You think, where is God? Where is my family? I want my friends to be like Job's friends. I feel alone. Now, the magic of faith, the wonderful thing of faith, is that we can read the Bible and know it's true. And God is ever present throughout our entire lifespan, including when we receive a bad diagnosis, including when we are dying. We don't have to wonder about that. Death has no power over us, so I want you to see how dying is no big deal for the writer of Thessalonians and Philippians. For God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we're awake or asleep, we might live with him. Death doesn't change a thing. If I am saved, if I have a relationship with God, whether I live or die, I am still with Christ. Death can't change that. Death losing its sting doesn't mean that death doesn't hurt, but it does mean that it doesn't have consequences for us. Philippians, to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I'm to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed to choose between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better, but to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Paul is saying that to live and to die is a choice between two positive options. And death cannot make one of them negative. Dying is a time of anticipation of hopes to be fulfilled. This is the frustrating part for me when I see Christians dying who don't want to die, is they want to hang on to life now. But listen, So this is the Hall of Fame of Faith. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. For a dying believer, there's an anticipation, a breathless anticipation, that they are finally going to get to the place that God has been preparing for them from the get-go. Next. There's a time for promises to be fulfilled. We do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. This speaks to how we continue to spiritually grow at the end of life. For this light and momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, the things that are unseen are eternal. This is a challenge. Are our eyes fixed on things that are unseen? Are we living with an eternal perspective? Then death can't hurt us. Then death means we are about to achieve what God has for us. Sometimes I think, you know, people ask me, well, why did God give me cancer? Or they question, you know, if God were good, why would he do these things to me? And I never say this to a patient, but I read this someplace, and the person said that once we're in heaven, there are going to be certain questions we don't have anymore. We're not going to be asking questions like that. It's not like I'm going to see you in heaven and say, well, how'd you get here? And you're going to say, car accident, I don't even know why I was in a car accident. Because you're going to be in glory. And there'll be no more mystery. That's how God chose to bring you home. I got cancer. I don't know why God gave me cancer. He gave you cancer to bring you home. And there are questions that we won't have in heaven. Dying is a time to continue to serve God's purpose. Romans 14. For if we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, that he might be the Lord of both the dead and the living. Dying is not a failure of faith in God, right? So there are people who believe in miracles, and they say, if I have faith of a mustard seed, I can pray. God has promised that if I pray, my prayer will be effective. I'm praying for healing. And it becomes this challenge, where do they have the faith the size of a mustard seed or not? And whether the person lives or dies will test their faith. That's how they know if their faith is real. In Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, John Bunyan does something actually fairly similar, if any of you read that book. But it's a setup for failure, because at some point, everybody dies. And if your faith depends on your prayers being effective and helping somebody live forever, ultimately the faith will be disappointed every time. Dying is a time to be a witness for God. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our mortal flesh. There is a witness a dying person has that none of us have until we are dying. Our mortal flesh will manifest God's glory in a way that when we are healthy, it does not manifest God's glory. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Next. Now, your death and the timing of it belongs to God. Now, this is where it differs dramatically from a medical perspective. The medical model is goals of care are your life, your choices. You document it. You tell other people. You put in a legal document where if somebody alters it, it's a felony, which is true for the state of Pennsylvania. But remember, the night before Jesus died, he's praying that he would not die. He's praying that the cup would be taken from him. My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. My Father, if this cannot pass, unless I drink it, your will be done. These are not our decisions at the end of the day. So I just had a 10th member in my office the other day. We're talking about advanced directives, and I said, you know, this is how most people make it. But for a Christian, this is a faith decision. The question is, have you lived out God's purpose for your life? And do you believe that at this time you have completed God's agenda for your life? If so, then you can be a DNR. I didn't mean that she had to be a full code otherwise, but I said ideally these type of documents would fulfill your faith. They would express your faith, and you would make these decisions in submission to the will of God. It's not that I want my mom to live to 150. That's not my decision, right? I want my mom to live forever. These are decisions we submit to the will of God. Even on the cross, and this is one of my friends who was speaking with Matt and myself at 10th, she said, even while Jesus on the cross, he was challenged, if you are the Son of God, save yourself. And he chose not to. And so the demonstration of his glory and his deity was to not try to live forever, but was to die. And if that's what it was for Jesus, how much more so for us? Now, here's the aspirational. Now, I recognize this is not how it's going to be for most of us, okay? I don't even know that this is going to be true for me. Aspirational goals are always dangerous, because when people fall short, you feel bad about yourself, right? I know I should exercise 30 minutes a day, I exercise 10, I feel bad about myself. You know, I should be a certain health. I'm not. Feel bad about myself. Nevertheless, aspirational goals for dying well. One is for yourself. And this comes from a book by a guy named John Dunlop. It'll be at the end. One is for yourself. Have you been purposeful first in living well? And then are you going to be purposeful in dying? I will tell you, it's hard to live a crummy life your whole life and then suddenly at the end of life want to make everything right. Right? If you've ticked off people your whole life, your kids, your spouse, everybody else, and you're estranged from everybody else, the chance of you reconciling to everybody at the end of life is probably close to zero. I've seen people try. It doesn't work that well. We accept our mortality. We prepare to die. We examine our faith. We pray. We anticipate, remind ourselves of the promises of God, what he has for us in eternity. Some of the goals include social goals for other people. Next. Reconciling with others. Ira Byock, who wrote, his reference will be at the end, talks about reconciling with others. He is not a Christian physician, but he writes absolutely fantastic stuff. And he has a book called The Four Important Things, where he says, I love you, I thank you, forgive me, I forgive you. He gives this script to families, to patients at the end of life. Separately, he also gives it to their children as a way to reconcile at the end of life. witness to others, to pass on a spiritual legacy. The question is, what's the most important thing you're going to pass on when you die? It's not your money. It's never money. It's going to be the spiritual legacy you pass on. Are the people around you ready to hear it? If not, can you write them a letter? Can you record a message? Are you going to write something down, talk to somebody, have a conversation about what God has meant to you your whole life and what you want them to know about you after you die? Can you tell others about Jesus in the moment or afterwards? Can you achieve closure and peace? And can you have a mindset of eternity throughout this whole process? That would be ideal, wouldn't it? Unfortunately, it's often messy. I sometimes tell people dying is a lot like giving birth. You might have this birthing plan where you know what hospital you want to go to and who you want to be there, and then all of a sudden you have a crash C-section, you end up delivering at home on your kitchen table, and it doesn't end up the way you like. Dying is the same way. It really is. It is really hard, for example, to time being at somebody's bedside the moment they die. It's happened to me a number of times, almost by chance, but it's hard to time that. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is diseases are unexpected. They can happen faster than you think. They can happen slower than you think. They can have unexpected complications, just unexpected manifestations of the disease. They can zag in ways you're not expecting. There can be a lot of suffering, and again, cognitive impairment, where a person loses the ability to communicate for some time before they die. For social reasons, dealing with difficult families or difficult family dynamics, it's too judgmental to say difficult families, but dealing with difficult family dynamics is what I do every single day. These bring out issues from childhood. I've had 70-year-old siblings in my office talking about how mom treated them when they were kids. I kid you not. It just brings up so much emotion going back to when people were little. And there is nothing in life that we seem to get right the first time. There is no stage of life where you will look back and say, I nailed it. Okay? It's laughable. And this stage of life is the same, right? Our first years of college are never go exactly the way we think. Our first years of marriage never go the way we think. Our first careers never go the way we think. Parenting never goes the way we think. And neither does dying, okay? So we are afraid, we're anxious, we're scared. Let's face it, we lack in faith sometimes. We have anger and doubts. And we ask ourselves, did we make a right decision? In the worst case, did I kill my mother or father by making a certain decision? But the solution is to be very thankful that God is gracious. God knows we never get anything right the first time. That's the whole point of having a Savior. I would also encourage to never try to do any of this alone. It doesn't mean that your friend's going to have amazing advice, but just don't try to go through difficult things like this alone. And in order for people to show you grace, you have to be gracious to them. You have to give them permission to tell you stuff you already know. If you're the type of person that says to people, don't tell me that, I already know it, you're going to have a hard time being encouraged. Encouragement is all about reminding people of the truths of God that they have already learned. So you have to open yourselves to being encouraged. There's a time to encourage people in their faith, to remind them of things that they know. Scared of dying? Remember Psalm 23. God is still your shepherd in this moment. Feel like God is absent? God is present. You're reminding people of things they know. And you're sitting bedside. You don't have to say anything. Your goal is to not let people suffer alone. My goal is to not let people suffer alone, even if the only thing I can bring is being physically present. So putting it all together, when you think about death and dying, number one, pray. Number two, pray for God to be sovereign, to help you submit to his will. It's not easy. If it's not easy for Jesus to submit to the will of the Father, it's not easy for us, and we shouldn't pretend. We should pray for clarity about our purpose. We should talk to our family, talk to your pastor, listen to your doctor honestly. You want them to be honest with you. There's a lot of studies that doctors don't actually tell patients what they're thinking because they're afraid of telling the patient what they're thinking. I've done it a million times, walked out of the room, knew the patient was dying and didn't say it. Think about what it means to complete your agenda, which means you have to have an agenda in the first place, and record your wishes. I think we're doing okay. All right, now this is what the handouts are in front of you. Questions? All right, we'll keep going. The Conversation Starter Kit, next slide, is created by a journalist, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist named Ellen Good. The thing I like about this is it's not written by a doctor, it's not written by a physician. So it's readable. It's understandable. I've had lawyers come into my office, tell me that after I explained things to them, said, oh, I guess I didn't really understand what this was all about. And they charge people money to go over things like this. So this document by Ellen Goodman called the Conversation Starter Kit, it's a conversation starter because it's meant help families have conversations about these sort of topics. It is meant for a person to fill it out, think about it, and then talk to their family members. I've given it to my parents because my parents are used to this by now. It is not a legal document. It is meant to provide as a guide for discussion. It is meant to ask in a bunch of Likert scales and open-ended questions, if you had to choose, living in a nursing home is perfectly tolerable to me, or I want to live as independently as possible. I'm worried I'm not going to receive enough care. I'm worried I'm going to receive too much care. When I die, I want to be by myself. When I die, I want to be with others. And it's a snapshot of how a person feels in time. It's not a legal document. It's easy to fill out. You guys can probably fill it out and share it with the person sitting next to you if we have time. Next, a healthcare power of attorney. There's two types. One is when it goes into effect only when you lack capacity, which is a non-durable power of attorney. The other, it goes into effect now. So I can designate my wife as a durable healthcare power of attorney. She can start calling my doctor, making decisions for me, and communicating with my doctors, even though I'm fairly competent right now. The rules can differ in different states. Power of attorneys are state rules. So some states will grant certain authorities and some will not. Generally speaking, you can initiate, withhold, withdraw care. And in the state of Pennsylvania, a power of attorney can override a person's living will 100%. I'll give you an example. So a patient of mine was Baptist. He was dying. His hemoglobin was like 6.0. Needed a blood transfusion. His sister, his power of attorney, is a Jehovah's Witness, said under no circumstances can you give him a blood transfusion. We said, but that's not what he would have wanted. She's like, I know that. I know he's not a Jehovah's Witness. I know he would have wanted it, but he made me the power of attorney. It's against my religion to authorize it. We checked with our lawyers, and they said she's right. He ended up dying. And so pick your power of attorneys very carefully. Yes. So from a physician's perspective, pick one. It's easier for me to deal with one than three. Too many phone calls. It depends on how you set it up. So my parents have designated my older brother as a power of attorney. Totally fine with me. My brother, sister, and I make decisions together anyway. And it's practical to have one person there. I've had situations where two sons and two daughters disagreed. And in the state of Pennsylvania, if there's a tie, then you can't make a decision. It has to be majority, okay, if you don't designate anybody. So then there were some decisions. Then one of the sons said, I'm actually going to defer to my granddaughter who's a nurse. Well, when the Penn lawyers heard that, it's now not 2 versus 2. He took himself out of the equation. It was 2 versus 1, and we proceeded with the development plan. So from practical reasons, you want to designate one. Now, as a parent, you want your kids to be on the same page. One way to do that is that you make it clear to them what it is that matters to you. So one question I ask people all the time, if your loved one could wake up for 10 minutes and speak for themselves, what would they say? And then they had to go back to being how they are now. And that orients people to what the person would have wanted if they could speak for themselves. That's where a good living will ease relational issues among children by being clear. But yes, power of attorney is used now. Yeah. Next. So a power of attorney is about picking somebody. A living will is making decisions ahead of time. Again, if you don't like planning your itinerary from 7 a.m. to midnight on vacation 3 weeks before you get to Florida, living wills might not be your cup of tea. They tend to be future-oriented documents. When I lack capacity, if I have an end-stage medical condition, or I'm permanently unconscious, the second one is almost unheard of. It rarely happens. Most people don't die in a persistent vegetative state. The debate of what is end-stage is questionable. When does dementia become end-stage? Well, from diagnosis to a certain extent. But I direct that I be given healthcare treatment. This is copy and pasted from the Pennsylvania Advanced Directives. I direct that I be given a healthcare treatment to relieve my pain, provide comfort, even if such treatment might shorten my life, suppress my appetite, my breathing, be habit-forming. I direct all life-prolonging procedures be withheld or withdrawn. Next slide. I specifically do not want any of the following procedures. If you wish to receive any of these treatments, write, "I do want," after the treatment. You can see how confusing this is. Written by lawyers. Actually, legislators. So CPR, breathing machine, kidney machine, surgery, chemotherapy, antibiotics. This is a typical advanced directive, or a living will, I should say. An advanced directive is a power of attorney plus a living will. So this is a typical living will. It asks people to make specific medical decisions ahead of time. This would be hard for me to fill out. I don't have any of these medical problems right now. It'd be hard for me to anticipate what scenarios this would occur. But it is contextualized. If I'm in a persistent vegetative state or I have a terminal condition, then I would or would not want these type of decisions. The challenge is that these are future-looking documents. And there are people where the future is always future. And you say to somebody, but they filled out this document. They're like, yeah, but that's when they're terminal. They're not terminal now. And I'm looking at the patient. I'm like, they're pretty terminal. They're like, no, they're doing great. And that's where these documents fall short. That's usually the argument I get in with people. Next document. So the POLS form is the other one you guys have in front of you. Physician order for life-sustaining treatment. As opposed to an advanced directive, it's a current care directive. It has 4 boxes, A, B, C, D. Part A, when I have no pulse, I'm not breathing. When I am dead. I want you to try to bring me back to life. I don't want you to try to bring me back to life. Right? There's no question. There's no qualifiers. It's just a blanket statement. Part B, while I'm alive, I want full hospital care, including ICU care, limited hospital care, which is hospital care without ICU, no hospital care. Breaks it into just 3 categorized steps. Part C is antibiotics. I tell you, I often leave that blank. Part D is artificial feeding. I usually leave that blank as well. Yes. That's why I don't like talking about this, because the anticipated scenarios are so varied. So somebody can have a stroke where they can't eat, but 90% of those patients will go on to be able to eat. You can have an end-stage neurological condition where putting in a feeding tube doesn't prolong life at all, but half of people get medical physical restraints to keep them from pulling it out. I just find it too difficult to discuss this, that until I'm presented with a specific scenario, where I can discuss specific pros and cons and prognosis, I don't really see the point. That's me. Some people might call that a cop-out. Yeah.
So, my dad was in the hospital, and they put him in a theater and everything. And he would rip it out, right? And then it got to a point where he got really good at it, but he would take his tongue, and he would just press it out.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that. Tongue it out. Not necessarily. People will interpret that as like, this means he doesn't want it. Could just mean he's really confused. And it's uncomfortable. Yeah.
I have a quick question.
This could be filled out every day if you want. No, you could fill it out today.
Okay.
This is a legal document. Technically, it needs to be on pink paper,
but
it is a legal document where if somebody else tears it up, it's a felony. So if you sign it or your mom or dad signs it, the physician signs it, it's a legal document. You don't need to pay any fee. It's downloadable, but this is a legal document.
Okay.
If, as a geriatrician, I don't like filling out advanced directives because most of my patients need limits and directives for today. So I don't fill out a lot of advanced directives. I fill out a ton of posts. I fill them out in my office, fill them out in the nursing home, fill them out in the hospital. I like, in a dream world, I like to pair this with the conversation starter kit. So that way I see the values that fed into it. Because if somebody says to me, I had a woman say to me, I want to be comfortable. It's all I care about. She had end-stage renal disease. We were thinking about starting her in dialysis. Everybody's like, well, let's put her on hospice. So then I asked her. I said, well, would you consider dialysis comfortable? She goes, yeah, sure. So she started dialysis and she was fine because the translation of values to a medical plan, it depends on the person. And so I like seeing the values in the conversation starter kit. And I like to see how the patient interprets that into a medical care plan. Yep. All right, next slide. So why fill these out? I think for a person to fill this out, it relieves burden and stress on the family. Actually, I think that's one of the main points. I think it is an opportunity also to express one's faith. And ensure that your wishes are carried out. Why not fill it out? Maybe you can't make decisions ahead of time. And I've learned to be at peace with that as a physician, to just walk with people in the moment. Even though I can read the Wikipedia plot summary ending, some patients just can't see it, and they just have to walk through each step in real time. And some situations are just flat out hard to predict. So I would have a good power of attorney or a surrogate decision maker, and an uncertainty, I would use time-limited trials liberally. I would want to be on a dialysis for 4 weeks. I would want to try this chemotherapy at least a couple times, things like that. I think we're almost at the end here. The one thing I didn't say earlier is that at the end of life is absolutely a time to worship God. And I was thinking about Bible verses that demonstrated this, and I decided that I don't need anything about Bible verses. There are hymns. From my Jesus, I love thee. I'll love thee in life. I will love thee in death, and praise thee as long as thou lendest me breath, and say when the death dew lies cold on my brow, if ever I love thee, my Jesus, 'tis now. All the way my Savior leads me, all the fullness of his grace, perfect rest to me is promised in my Father's blessed embrace. When my spirit clothed immortal wings its flight to realms of day, this my song through endless ages, Jesus led me all the way. He leadeth me, I'll love thee in life. Oh, and when my task on earth is done, when by thy grace thy victory's won, even death's cold wave I will not flee, since thou in triumph leadest me. And a verse that we don't sing all the time in Come Thou Fount is, oh, that day when freed from sinning I shall see thy lovely face. Clothed then in the blood-washed linen, how I'll sing thy wondrous grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry. Take my ransomed soul away. send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. I think if we over-medicalize the end of life, we miss out on what God has for people at the end of life. And if our medical decisions and our spiritual lives stay separate, we miss sort of the unity that a lot of Christians that have walked before us had, where at the end of their life, they were preparing, they were growing spiritually, they were witnessing, they were in prayer, and they were worshiping. And the time that they had at the end of their life was as much a part of their life as the beginning of their life. Slide. So here's some of the references. You can always email me. I sent my slides to Matt, Pastor Raymond. I guess for questions, maybe just some. Yeah. In light of what? Okay, yeah.
Because it comes up with long-term care and safety.
Sure.
So what's good is they have a professional that cares and is interested in talking about these things. Now, the caveat is, like, obviously, we're not medical professionals. So is there anywhere, when you think about this broader discussion, where you should say, there's a put a fence around it and a potential violence should stop at this point and maybe tell a client to go seek the advice of a health care professional?
I mean, this is where financial planning, healthcare professionals, and pastors all come together to make sure that everything is aligned and pointing in the right direction. So, for example, if a person is so worried about how they're passing on their finances, but having a plan for how they're going to pass on spiritual legacy, well, they got the cart before the horse, right? And so I do think there's opportunities for redirection, or even in that setting, or to making it more complete. Yeah.
I used to be a social worker in a nursing home setting. So we worked with those folks a lot.
Yeah.
I ended up quitting because they were, the state got involved because there was a lot of negligence with all of those things. And I was thinking about what you were saying about, like, do we have to do everything, like when you're advocating for the right thing.
So these are people who are full code, but they ended up not being resuscitated, or people who are DNR, and they ended up being coded? Like, which was both ways? Well, fraud is an issue. That's a... Yeah. I think one of our goals is to make sure that these documents reflect the person's wishes as well as possible. I mean, I think what you're dealing with is more like a whistleblowing type of situation, right? Who do you tell? Do you tolerate the situation where there's document fraud going on that has severe consequences for patients? There are ways to report this. Last summer, I did some work with the state attorney generals over nursing home issues. And yes, you do. You can report it. But I think you also have to remember just how messy life and death is. That God's still sovereign, and he's still gracious. So I've had issues, times where we actually had two different documents in the chart, or somehow a document got lost, the person ended up getting coded that didn't want to be coded, or vice versa. I mean, there are just legitimately messy situations. I always figure it's better for me to be involved when it's messy than to not be involved when it's messy and to try to make the best of it. But you know, you try to engage and make the best of it, it's still really messy. No, I mean, you always double check. My intentions are never perfect myself. But things happen. I've had scheduled appointment times to meet with people only to have them code the day before. And so, you know, that happens. And I think to myself, man, if only I had talked to them earlier, this outcome would have been different. The person ends up on a ventilator. But the timing of it isn't by accident, right? And so I have to trust that God's sovereignty can overrule even my mistakes and all the fraud and all the errors that happen, that God can still show graciousness and kindness, and so can I. But you do hold people accountable. I have somebody at my nursing home. She's terrible at filling out these forms with families. Just gets it wrong. I have to follow behind her and just correct things. It happens. Yeah. I would say two things. One is sometimes I refer because I'm unsure, and I know I'm unsure. Second is if I feel there's not a sense of trust. I mean, the goal for me for families is that they have peace. No matter what happens, they have peace. They're not going to have peace if they don't trust me. So I'm not achieving anything by having them follow my advice, even if I think it's perfect advice. If they don't trust me, what's the point? They should find somebody they trust, because they will have doubts. I don't pretend to be the right physician for everybody. It's like dating, right? It doesn't always work out. So if a person doesn't trust me, that's fine. I'll just call it a day and say, hey, listen, it seems like you need to hear something else, and just to let it be. That's okay, yeah. Yeah, so step one, I think we don't talk about death enough in a Christian setting, so people actually aren't prepared. Even long-standing Christians just are not prepared. So I do think, I like John Dunlop's book. There's a lot of Christian authors who have written books on end of life and aging issues. But obviously, there's plenty of Bible verses. I mean, there's a lot of teaching. We just tend to ignore it all. But ideally, your dad would grow. And if he doesn't want to engage in that, because not everybody does, then you just do your best. Remember that 99% of the time for older adults, when they die, it's usually because of an underlying medical decision. I'll be honest, some of these decisions aren't big decisions. The person's going to die anyway. I had this guy, he was like in his 97. He was asking me if he should eat blueberries to prevent cancer. And he had end-stage heart failure, end-stage renal disease. Within 6 months, he was going to be dead. He's asking me about blueberries. So one day, he comes into my office, and his blood pressure is so low that he's faint, and he's full of fluid. And I say to him, listen, there is nothing else that we can do for your heart and lungs, or for your heart and your kidneys. And his wife is like, well, you're saying we should go to the ER? I'm like, they can't do anything in the ER. She's like, should he get a transplant? I'm like, can't do that either. I said, we're at a point where we can't do this. And he looks at her and says, you know, the doctor's saying to you, you're not going to have a husband anymore, right? It was too difficult for her to even engage in these type of topics. They'd been married 75 years. And it's messy, right? So when people have trouble engaging, what killed him isn't whether she made him pro, like, full code or no code, right? I could say to her, you know, Mrs. Smith, if you have a big decision to make about whether your husband gets coded or not, and I could make her think for the rest of her life, which wasn't going to be long either, that she made a decision that killed her husband. Her husband was going to die no matter what anybody did. None of the decisions were big decisions. His medical fate was just etched in stone. And so one thing you just have to make sure is you don't assume the burden more than you should. Because, you know, there's a million things that happen that leads up to somebody's death. And the final decision is usually not the major issue. So there's graciousness in that, right? Actually, yeah, and both of you, you first, then you. Yeah, that's tough. So I will say I cheat because most of my patients in West Philly are older African-American Christians, the vast majority. So most of my patients are Christian. One is you always show people kindness, right? So Christian or not, they don't go through this process alone. I'm with them as I would anybody else. You're patient, you're gracious, no blaming, shaming, none of that. You ask them if they have hope. That one of my lines is, when you're discouraged, where do you get your hope from? Okay, when you're feeling down, what picks you up? What are your sources? And I ask people what that is. And then I say, you know, I have patients who have sources of hope, or they draw strength from other areas. And I'm in a physician's office. There are certain things I can say, certain things I can't. But I try to have them engage with me. What would that be? I can even say, you know, when I'm dealing with suffering, this is how I've dealt with it. And if they invite me to tell them more, I will absolutely tell them more. And if they don't want to engage me, I still take care of them as best as I can. Yeah. Yeah, you're honoring their wishes, you're honoring their autonomy, you are being with them, you're assuming the burden for a decision that maybe they couldn't make themselves in order to give them peace, or you are helping them prepare to enter heaven. There's a lot of ways that difficult roles can be still quite meaningful. All right. I think time's up. So I will let you guys go. I'll stick around for a little bit.